We're discussing the repercussions of plea deals in the justice system here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. According to the ACLU, plea bargaining takes place tens of thousands of times every day in our country. It's how more than 95% of all state and federal convictions occur. And now research by professors at UW Law School looks at the extent to which prosecutors use their plea bargaining power to preserve convictions. Have you ever taken a plea deal? What were the circumstances? It's 800-642-1234. Keith Findley is a UW Law School professor. He co-authored the paper called Plea Bargaining in the Shadow of a Retrial, Bargain Away Innocence. Keith, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks so much. I'm very happy to be with you.
Well, give us some working knowledge first of the court system. How do plea bargains work? What is a plea bargain?
So a plea bargain is a negotiated settlement of a criminal case. So the way it works is that person is charged with a crime, and then prosecutors have vast discretion about what to charge, what kind of penalties to seek, what to sort of threaten the defendant with. And then the parties engage in negotiation to agree on what the outcome will be. And that can take two forms. One form is called charge bargaining, which is where you bargain away some charges. And the other is sentence bargaining, where you bargain for a particular sentence or a recommendation for a particular sentence. In Wisconsin, judges are not bound by sentence bargains, but they can impose whatever they want. But the a joint agreement for a particular sentence carries a great deal of weight. The general theory in the literature is that, and that's what the title of the paper comes from, is that parties tend to bargain in the shadow of a trial, meaning they will assess what the likely outcome of the case would be, what the penalty would be after a trial, and then discount that by the likelihood of conviction. So, for example, if the parties look at a case where the expected outcome after trial might be 10 years in prison, but they think there's about an 80% chance of conviction, an appropriate rational settlement to both parties would be a plea bargain to about 8 years in prison. That's sort of the dominant theory right now of how this process works.
Almost, I hear it's like you're wagering a bet. Like for defendants, if they have strong defenses, and even if they're innocent, they have a lot of pressure to err on the side of caution and accept a plea.
Absolutely. And it is sort of a gamble, because anytime you go to trial, you just don't know what will happen, what a jury will do. It's always a risky proposition, no matter how strong your claim of innocence or from the prosecutor's perspective, how strong their proof of guilt. You never know what's going to happen. And so you make a calculated risk, a guess as to what the outcome would have, what would be. In our system, this tends to mean that when assessing those risks, prosecutors are given particularly immense power and authority to sort of impose onerous potential consequences that enhance the likelihood that a person will accept a plea, whether they're guilty or not. And that comes in the form that over the last decades, we have seen legislatures add penalty crime after crime after crime to the statutes and ratchet up penalties so immensely. When you put that together with the fact that prosecutors have virtually unreviewable discretion about what to charge and what penalties to seek, as long as it's within the statutes, what that means is prosecutors can pile on charges and ratchet up the potential exposure far beyond what they actually want or believe would be just. But imposing immense risks that to a rational criminal defendant are unacceptable and induce them to seek ways to minimize the potential harm, whether they're guilty or innocent.
We're talking with Keith Findley, who's a professor at the UW Law School, co-authored this new paper on plea bargaining. It's called Plea Bargaining in the Shadow of a Retrial. You can join in. Do prosecutors have too much leeway to use plea bargains? How should that be addressed? 800-642-1234. Keith, let's look at your research seeming to show that plea bargaining puts people who are likely innocent under pressure to take a plea deal. Can you elaborate on your findings?
Yeah, sure. The literature has long theorized that there is what scholars call an innocence problem in plea bargaining. And that is just the very nature of the enterprise that I've just described to you is one that would be likely to induce innocent people to plead guilty to avoid the risk of even harsher outcomes. And there's some psychological studies, laboratory studies, that confirm that in a laboratory setting, people can indeed be induced to accept plea bargains to things they did not do. So what we sought to do was to examine that phenomenon in the real world, in real cases. The problem in real cases, of course, is that unlike the laboratory, we usually don't have access to ground truth. It's hard to identify who's actually innocent and who's not. So the way we went about it was to look at cases where people represented by innocence projects, innocence advocacy organizations, were seeking post-conviction relief in a case where they'd already been convicted. Now, this is not a perfect proxy for innocence because some of these people will no doubt be guilty despite their claim of innocence. But for a lot of complicated reasons that we explain in the paper, this is a pretty good proxy for actual innocence, given all the screening that goes through these cases before they ever make it to the litigation process. And so we looked at what was happening in these cases when people represented by actual innocence organizations sought a new trial, and then when courts actually granted them relief, that is, vacated their convictions and ordered a new trial. And what we found was that in these cases, cases with a uniquely high likelihood of actual innocence, and most of these are very serious crimes, by the way, prosecutors offered plea bargains in an attempt to preserve the convictions in about a quarter of the cases. And even perhaps more telling than that, when they offered plea bargains, the plea bargains they offered were uniformly extraordinarily generous. That is, plea bargains that sought to extract virtually nothing more from the defendant except preservation of the conviction. So in about 9 out of 10 of these plea offers, the plea bargain was to time served. Now, remember, which means it's a get out of jail free card to the defendant. But remember, these are largely murders, rapes, cases like this, cases where a prosecutor would never contemplate time served from the get go. And so this is given that trial shadow theory that I was describing before. This would seem to suggest that prosecutors are recognizing that in these cases, the likelihood of conviction at a new trial is close to zero. And yet they're still offering these plea bargains in an attempt to preserve these convictions.
But these irresistible plea bargains, how does that work for defendants of color? What about, minority and how those plea bargains look?
Well, it's probably not going to be a big surprise to recognize that this process tends to work particularly to the disadvantage of people of color. What we know from a lot of research is that at virtually every step of the criminal justice system, racial minorities are treated more harshly and are at a greater disadvantage than their white counterparts. We know that even in areas where the two racial groups commit crimes at about the same rate, the arrest rate for Blacks is much higher than for whites. Once they're arrested, the conviction rate is higher. Once they're convicted, the rate of sentence to prison is higher. And when we look at the exoneration cases, that is the cases where we know a person was wrongly convicted, once again, we see that for most crimes, Blacks are disproportionately affected by wrongful convictions as well. So this is a problem that uniquely impacts racial minorities, but we also have research that suggests that Blacks are probably at a greater disadvantage in the plea bargaining process itself, in part because implicit biases may be in place that will motivate system actors to try to preserve those convictions even more strenuously, but also because Black people tend to have far less confidence in the criminal justice system than their white counterparts, which means that the risks of going to trial look even greater to them. And so they may be, I'm hypothesizing here, they may be more vulnerable to the coercive effect of really generous plea offers.
UW Law School professor Keith Findley co-founded the Wisconsin Innocence Project more than two decades ago. He and his colleagues have looked at the power of plea bargaining in a new study. Do prosecutors have too much leeway to use plea bargains? How should it be addressed? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Keith Findley here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing the inner workings of plea deals in the justice system. New research out of the UW Law School. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jury trials in America are rare. Attorneys resolve the lion's share of cases through plea bargaining, as we've been talking about. That means the defendant waives their right to a trial, agrees to plead guilty to certain charges. The ACLU concluded that coercive plea bargaining has poisoned the criminal justice system, and criminal case dockets have become so overloaded over the past half century that, quote, conveyor belt plea bargaining has become the only release valve, end quote. UW Law School professor Keith Findley and his colleagues looked into the power of plea bargains, and he stays with us for about nine more minutes. Keith, we had a caller who couldn't stay with us. They want to know if coercion plays a role in plea bargains.
Well, sure. I mean, it all depends on how you define coercion, though. Under the law, a plea bargain that's coerced is invalid. But because a plea bargain involves waiver of a whole host of constitutional rights. The right to a jury trial, the right to proof beyond a reasonable doubt, the right to remain silent. The list goes on. And so the courts, in theory, want to make sure that those pleas are entered and the legal term for that is knowingly, voluntarily, and intelligently, which means without coercion. The problem comes in, though, in identifying what is coercion. And what has been theorized and what I think our research supports is that pleas that look on their face to meet that legal standard of voluntariness, in fact, may in reality be coercive in the sense that to the criminal defendant, the risks of proceeding to trial are so overwhelming compared to the overly generous offer that's being made that it's kind of like, the Godfather, they made an offer you can't refuse. So in that sense, they appear to be coercive.
I understand that plea bargains have surged over time, and at the same time, jury trials have become more time-consuming, more complex, lawyers drawing them out. Are there forces at work here with jury trials being this long, involved legal mechanism?
That may be part of what's going on, but my suspicion that I think is supported by the literature is that probably the primary factor that's driving the disappearance of jury trials and the emergence of the plea process as the dominant process for resolving criminal cases is the over criminalization of our statutes. That is the explosion of options that are available to criminal prosecutors. And the ratcheting up of statutory maximum penalties. Since the 70s, essentially, we have seen a political movement that has been fairly sustained until recently involving get tough on crime, which means every time something goes wrong, the legislatures create a new crime and the penalties keep going up higher and higher. The reason that causes trials to disappear is that because it gives prosecutors such an arsenal to work with. Every time we add to the statutes or add to the penalties, you strengthen the hand of the prosecutors so they are able to charge far more than what they really want. And it allows them to ratchet up the potential penalties so high that most rational defendants simply can't take the risk of going to trial. It's a world in which, as some commentators have noticed, it's ironic that the more laws we have, the less relevant the law becomes, because it gives prosecutors so many options that the law doesn't dictate the outcome so much as does the preferences of the prosecutor.
Let's bring on a caller now. Lauren is joining us from Burlington. Hi, Lauren. What would you like to add?
Hi. I guess I'm looking at things from two perspectives. I used to be an insurance claims adjuster who handled civil cases. I am also now a mental health therapist, so I'm seeing some of the criminal aspects of it. I have a couple of clients who are involved in the system as we speak. Mike, I have two views on this. Both related to that, I believe the justice system is broken. I do not believe that there is justice anymore, anywhere in the country. First reason, people that are innocent are having to plead guilty to things that they do not do because they are looking at long jail sentences, a chance that the jury will find them guilty anyway because of color, socioeconomic status. Second, I am aware of a case of a Facebook friend who was brutally, brutally murdered 2 years ago. There has not been a preliminary hearing, not one preliminary hearing. The victims are videotaped the killing of this gentleman. He was totally tied into a bed.
And
totally
Lauren, I want to pause here for a moment, and because I think you bring up a really good point on the role of victims in plea bargaining. What happens to the victims, Keith?
Well, victims have certain rights in our legal system, and including to be apprised of the proceedings and the nature of the bargains. And generally speaking, the prosecutor is required to notify them of what's going on and hear their concerns. But they aren't parties in the litigation, so they are not direct negotiators in the plea bargaining process.
Keith Findley, professor at the UW Law School, co-author of a paper on plea bargaining. You can join in with your thoughts, 800-642-1234. So, Keith, you know, here we're driving at this, but if we almost never test prosecution's evidence through a trial, or like 95% of the time we don't, then how can you get at the truth of what happened in a case? What I'm really asking, what is the solution here?
Well, you know, there are a number of potential solutions, large and small. I mean, given what I've said already, probably the most effective thing, but the one that is almost politically unthinkable and would require massive shifts, is to reduce the size, the imprint of the criminal justice system. That is, start repealing overlapping criminal statutes, start scaling back potential punishments so that prosecutors don't have that overwhelming advantage in the negotiating process quite so much. There are a lot of other ways you can sort of level the playing field as well. But then when it comes to the plea bargaining process itself, there are a number of proposals out there that are kind of interesting that generally involve injecting the judicial oversight into the process a little bit more. In our system, judges pretty much take a hands-off approach to the bargaining process, and for good reasons, because you don't want the judge to appear biased or to put pressure on someone to accept a plea bargain. But there are ways to inject some judicial oversight that can avoid those risks. One of the more interesting ones that I've seen that we talk about in the paper a little bit is a system where you could impose a process where you have what are known as trial penalty caps. And what that means is that if a prosecutor wants to offer a plea bargain, he can do so. It has to be on the record. And then if the plea bargain is rejected, everybody knows the case goes to trial. The penalty that can be imposed after a trial would be capped at a certain marginal increment above what the plea bargain was.
Oh.
That way we know that everyone knows going in that the risk of going to trial isn't just astronomical, and everybody knows what it will be up front. The incentive for the prosecutor has for offering overly generous and therefore coercive plea bargains is reduced because they know it will tie their own hands later if they go to trial. So there are things like that that can happen. In the end, what we really need as well, because regardless of what we do, prosecutors are going to remain probably the most powerful actors in our criminal justice system and certainly in the plea bargaining process. What we really need also is prosecutors to take the lead themselves, to impose some constraints on their own ability to charge more than they really want, and to negotiate in ways that are not coercive.
Keith, thank you for joining us.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks for letting me talk about the research.
Keith Findley is a professor at the UW Law School, co-founder of the Wisconsin Innocence Project, co-author of a new paper on plea bargaining published in the Wisconsin Law Review. We have a link, by the way, at WPR.org/mornings. Stay with us. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Wisconsin joined a nationwide task force this week to try to cut down on illegal robocalls. The National Consumer Law Center says Americans received over 50 billion robocalls last year. Dozens of attorneys general will target their investigations and litigations against telecom companies and their role in not preventing these scam calls. So join in on your experience with robocalls, what you do when you get them, 800-642-1234. Michael Domke is director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection within the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. Michael, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
So how often is your Bureau of Consumer Protection receiving complaints about these robocalls?
We receive complaints every single day, whether they're phone inquiries, emails, or filing a formal complaint.
What do you do with these complaints?
Well, a variety of things, depending on the origin of the complaint. You know, first we'll try and identify where the source is or get a little bit more information, and then we can track them down. But there is really a variety of calls that are ways that it can come in. So it depends on the nature of it.
Do you see trends when you watch the day-to-day traffic of these complaints?
We do see trends. Typically, they're across types of industries, such as, you know, we'll see robocalls coming in trying to identify themselves as a lottery or a local lottery winner. Recently, we've seen that one spike up, and they're attempting to portray they want to share their winnings. And so these calls will keep coming in. And what they're trying to do is to get somebody to answer the phone or hit one of the keys to show that the live person is there. And that's their hook in.
So lottery winnings would be one example. Are there other common scams involving robocalls that people get?
You bet. So a couple of the other most common ones are extended car warranties. They'll be calling and you'll hear a message that says your warranty is expiring, you need to call soon, or offering to say, you know, well, a super great deal on extended coverage for a particular vehicle. And sometimes they're very crafty and they'll actually know what vehicle you have. And they'll get that whether through public information or some other list or even a solicitation that you signed up for. Another one is we'll see a lot recently is the Amazon. So everyone, you know, recently starts consuming from Amazon or is ordering something. And so it's not atypical for a consumer to receive a call from them. And in this scam, what they're doing is saying, hey, we couldn't deliver your package. So we need to verify some of your personal information. Or they'll say there was a problem with your account and your payment didn't go through. So they'll ask you to change your payment method over the phone. And those are all being done to try and get more of your personal information so they can use that for nefarious purposes. Another one that is quite common are utility scams. And we'll see this from, they'll portray to be local carriers. And they'll tell you, hey, your bill is overdue. And so they'll require payment immediately on the phone, or they're going to threaten to have someone come out and disconnect your service. You know, people, of course, will get scared. You know, summer, they're going to want their air conditioning, and winter, they certainly need their heat. So people are more prone to react emotionally and give that information without thinking it through.
Let's step back for just a moment and learn, because not all robocalls are illegal. What kinds of robocalls are allowed without my permission?
Well, it's a great question. And I think this is one of the most common misconceptions about when you sign up for, you know, a list is calls to existing customers are allowed. So if you have a relationship with your local lender, maybe a mortgage company, a credit card, those companies are allowed to call you. And whether that's to follow up on certain information, make you an offer, that is allowed. Another is if you've given any verbal or written permission for a company to call you. One of these areas that people probably don't realize that they're actually giving written permission are when you see a sweepstakes or enter to win this prize. Maybe you're out and you see a car sitting and it's got one of those big boxes and it says enter your information here. Oftentimes, if you read the fine print, you're giving permission for whoever's promoting that particular prize to contact you. And then you'll start receiving calls, you know, from them. And then another one that's probably most relevant right now, and as we'll see, you know, for the remainder of the year, are political campaigns.
Yes.
Or polls or surveys are allowed.
So, and yes, election season is heating up. And I would imagine then the volume of these robocalls we might receive would increase. And these are legal.
You're absolutely right. You know, with the primary election next Tuesday, I wouldn't be surprised if we're being bombarded with those calls already. And as we get closer to the governor's election, you know, at the end of the year, you're going to see them continue to ramp up.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Michael Domke, director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection, and that's housed within the Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, looking at the impact of robocalls, what to do when you get them, and where they go from here as attorneys general are banding together to litigate against telecom companies in this area. 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Michael, what should people do if they receive a robocall?
Well, the first thing I suggest they do is just hang up. Oftentimes, you're going to be able to tell if it's an automated call and someone that you don't want to deal with. Just hang up the phone. If you do happen to stay on, certainly don't say anything or press any buttons. New technology will show that if there's any voice that is detected, that will probably result in you getting even more phone calls. Or if that call directs you to hit a button to verify something, hitting that button is going to show that there is a real live user on the other line, and then they'll just keep calling to try and get you back on the line.
I've noticed in the calls that I've received, sometimes there's this odd space or gap before I'm able to hear anything when I do, like, accidentally, you know, hit answer on the cell phone. And I'm wondering if that space is any indication that it is a robocall.
I would say 99.9% of the time that it is. So, you know, with robocalls, they're really an automatic dialer. It's a robot that is sending out thousands of random phone numbers every minute. And what they're doing is just looking for one or two or a few people to pick up. And that pause that you're hearing is them sending out, and they're waiting for someone to say something, someone to hit a button. And then that will trigger the technology to let whoever the caller is know, hey, somebody's actually here. And then they'll proceed into, you know, whatever marketing or scam they're going to try and elicit.
Take us into the Do Not Call registry and the efforts there to stop robocalls, or at least try to rein them in. Explain the registry.
So the registry is a list of phone numbers that registered telemarketers must scrub their call lists from. And what it does is it really stops at calls and texts from legitimate telemarketers, because the law requires them to make sure they don't call anybody on that list. It's very easy to sign up for. It's free. You only have to register your number one time, and it's probably the best deterrent to stop getting phone calls.
But it doesn't, I mean, so if they're just telling the telemarketers who are, you know, following the rules not to call, I mean, it does leave this whole, you know, orbit of scammers who aren't following the rules to to still place these robocalls. What could make the Do Not Call registry more effective?
Well, the Do Not Call registry, you're absolutely correct. It applies to those who want to comply with the law and do things the right way. And certainly that is one tool, as long as they're complying with it, that can be useful. For those that aren't, you know, in 2019, the federal government passed the TRACED Act. And what that did is it required telecommunication companies to put in kind of an authentication process that would scrub out some of these bad actors or those that aren't using the certain technologies or looking at the list to try and deter some of those calls as well.
Do you see any movement in the Do Not Call registry for expansion of it in ways that would make it more difficult for, you know, these illegal scam calls to get through? Can the registry gain more teeth?
Well, the registry currently has an enforcement mechanism too. There are penalties for violators. So that is there. I think the concern is you're always going to have individuals or businesses or companies who are going to sidestep or try and thwart the law. And so as many, I guess, proactive measures as you put in place, ultimately you're still going to have people who are going to go around that. So that's where, you know, we come into play and with the authority to try and enforce those laws and rules and hold those companies accountable.
Let's take a call now. Dan is with us from Dickeyville. Dan, hi.
I like to, when I have time to do it, to mess with the scammers. I find it quite enjoyable, and I kind of look at it as somewhat of a public service, because if I'm wasting their time, maybe that's, you know, somebody's grandma or somebody who's not getting swindled that day because I'm wasting their time. Also, I gave some telemarketers a few years ago a fake name. If you've ever seen the show Burn Notice, it's a fake name from that show. It's a spy show. I told them my name was Chuck Finley. It's just a ridiculous name. And apparently they keep calling looking for that Chuck Finley. And usually it's a good indicator I'm being scammed as soon as they call looking for him.
Hmm.
Particularly the car warranty, when they ask me or list all the things that they're willing to fix with the warranty, I'll ask them questions like, do you guys replace license plates? I'll ask them, do you make license plates? And then they get confused by the question. I'm like, why would we make license plates? Well, that's what they make in prison, because that's where you're going to end up.
Dan, thank you for the call. Michael, you know, Dan playing along with this. Your thoughts there?
Well, I think Dan keyed in on the end of it there with getting more phone calls for Chuck Finley. You know, by playing along, there is certainly you could be, you know, wasting their time or taking that, but you're also opening yourself up to future calls. And some of these carriers may, or I'm sorry, some of these companies may also exchange lists and trade it, so they know if they have a live number, they may sell that to another company, opening you up to calls from even more people.
Michael Domke leads the state's Bureau of Consumer Protection under the umbrella of the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection as we explore how to stop menacing robocalls. Join in on these scam calls designed to steal money and your experience with the Do Not Call Registry, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about robocalls and robotexts, too. The Federal Communications Commission issued a warning in recent days that robotext scams are on the rise, could even surpass robocalls. Michael Domke, State Director of Wisconsin's Bureau of Consumer Protection, stays with us. Let's bring on a caller now. Katie is with us from Burlington. Katie, hi.
Yeah, I joined in late, so I apologize if I'm repeating something. But the one that's really scary to me is I've gotten a lot of these lately where the person will text you and they say, hey, Mary, haven't talked to you for a long time. How are you doing? Or they don't even use a name. They go, how have you been doing? I haven't talked to you for a while. And it's like a very benign, like, text. And what I think they're trying to do is get you to say, oh, I'm sorry, this isn't Mary, this is so-and-so. And like I told my mom, who's 86, I'm like, Mom, you know, don't be polite, because most people want to be polite and they want to get back to somebody and help them, you know, find the correct person. But it just happens all the time. So I know it's some type of a scam and I don't get it. So
Katie, yes, Katie, thank you for bringing that up. No, we have not gotten to robo-texts. Michael, what's going on there?
Well, I would say this is pretty much that falls in line with the robo-calls. It's just an even easier way to get the message out there and send them even further. The technology would allow you to send certain calls, but you're going to need phone lines, numbers to do that with texting. The technology makes it even more robust.
How are, state consumer protection authorities responding to more robotech scams? We hear the complaints now on the rise. What are you doing about it?
Well, we have seen the number of complaints keep coming in. Each year, telemarketing is the top complaint that we get. And within that telemarketing, there are robocalls, violations of the telemarketing and the do not call list that I mentioned, and also these types of scams, you know, which continue to grow in the types, styles, ways that they're administered. Well, what we do is we encourage anyone who receives one of these continuously, if they're on the do not call list, to file a complaint. And what we'll then do is follow up, trying to identify who the caller was, if they're a registered solicitor. You know, as we mentioned earlier, with these foreign companies calling in, it makes it extremely difficult to identify where they're coming from, especially if they're out of country. But the first step we can do is try and make sure that if they are located here domestically and they should be registered, we'll follow up and make sure they're aware of Wisconsin's law.
I found that some spam text messages said I could opt out by replying stop, S-T-O-P, which seemed like a reasonable thing to do. And I've seen that before. Should I do it?
Well, it's a great question, because, you know, the law requires that if you are going to send automated text, you have to give that option on how they can opt out. The problem is, you know, if you're responding to it, that may trigger them to in turn say, hey, we've got, you know, a live person, try to continue texting. I personally have hit stop on several of those and not hit an issue. The key thing I would encourage everyone to avoid is don't click on any links in the text. If you're sending a text back out, it may, you know, verify someone's there. But the real danger is clicking on a link.
Is there anything I could or should do to alert my wireless carrier that I'm getting these text messages?
Oh, you could certainly let them know, but really the best start is to just register on the do not call list. It includes phone calls and texts, and then that will let them know. And with the carrier also, you know, they should be doing their due diligence and scrubbing out those scam calls if they can. But as we mentioned earlier, there's always going to be, you know, bad actors who are going to get through.
We heard from Kristen in La Crosse, called and couldn't stay on the line, and wonders if services like Google Assist can help weed out these scam calls.
I'm not very familiar with the filters and what Google Assist does. I know that there is a lot of technology and a lot of carriers and a lot of software offerings that claim to do that, but I'm not positioned to really know how effective they are and whether or not they're going to achieve what you're looking for.
Okay. So what do you see out of the state announcing the nationwide anti-robocall litigation task force to investigate and take legal action against telecoms on these calls? How could the task force help reduce robocalls, do you think?
Well, the key to any task force is the opportunity to share information and kind of focus a much larger force into a particular issue. And in this one, this litigation group is focused on the voice over internet protocol providers, who are really suspected of being responsible for a majority of these foreign originating calls, also known as robocalls. And so what they're doing is they're going to try and take a look at the providers who are not taking the affirmative steps to curb that traffic that they're supposed to be, and or just outright ignoring those issues so that they can create revenue, because that is the whole purpose of robocalls, is to try and, you know, make money on who's going to answer. And they, so what they're going to do,
I was going to say, and they must make a lot of money because the robocalls just keep coming and coming. Is this lucrative?
It certainly is. You know, and the thing is, it's so easy. As I mentioned, you know, earlier in the call here, you can send thousands of calls per minute, you know, with just one software program. And then you're going to try and, you know, maybe have a bank of a few people who are going to answer those if they get a, somebody on the line. But if they miss a few, it's no loss to them because they are still going to continue to send millions and millions and millions of calls till they get a few people.
We're talking about robocalls, about robotexts with Michael Domke, who leads a state office focused on consumer protection. You can still time to share your experiences, 800-642-1234. Michael, we heard from John in Bangor, called and couldn't stay, and wonders if police can trace scam calls.
It's very difficult. You know, it's even more difficult with spoofing. And what spoofing is it puts up a fake number of who's actually calling. Mm. And so now I think you'll see a lot, the technology will show, and this is how the scams become so effective, because as you know, say the Amazon scam, they'll spoof that phone number so it shows up on your caller ID as Amazon. And so you don't actually know who's calling or what the number is behind the scenes. And the few instances where you do get those phone numbers, you could certainly try and call law enforcement. But I would encourage those people to call us first. You know, we have direct authority over the telemarketers, so we'd be a better bet to help with that.
In our last moments together, what else should consumers know and be aware of about these robocalls and robotexts?
Well, I would say do a few things to protect yourself up front. First is register on the Do Not Call registry, and you can do that at nocall.wisconsin.gov or by calling 888-382-1222. That's the best first step. The next is to help educate yourself. Our website has a lot of material on what you can look for. We keep updates. We issue alerts on current scams. And so really education is the best effort. And then once you're educated and know what you're supposed to do, the third is to follow through on it. You know, don't hang up on the robocalls. Don't click any links. Don't try and engage them unless you really want to be Chuck Finley for the day and do so. You can certainly do that, but just let it go and try and protect yourself.
Michael, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely. I'm happy to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to help share the message.
Michael Domke is Director of the Bureau of Consumer Protection within the Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. We have a link to the Wisconsin Do Not Call Registry at WPR.org/mornings. Just ahead, a new report from the American Farmland Trust estimates more than 515,000 acres of Wisconsin farmland could be lost between 2016 and 2040. We talk with two Wisconsin researchers about threats to farmland and land use planning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.